We're running. Yeah, can we smooth this a bit up? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, there has been a quite remarkable cultural development in South Africa over the last decade. And this has been a dramatic increase in the production and consumption of local crime fiction. Crime novels with South African settings, South African detectives, and South African criminals. Mike Nicol has recently listed over 40 authors who have written crime novels since 2004, some of them several novels. One of them, Michael Stanley, calls it an explosion of crime. Another, Margie Orford, writes of the viral spread of crime fiction through South Africa's literary canon. Crime fiction today has panels at literary festivals, debates take place online and in print, university departments are offering courses on the subject. Last year, an entire issue of the academic journal Current Writing was devoted to crime fiction in South Africa. And all of this attention has been triggered by the simple fact that more crime and detective fiction is being published in South Africa than at any time in the past. How does one explain this? There are some immediate and material reasons. There has been a rapid growth of publishing houses in South Africa since 1980. There are also many more bookshops that cater for commercial fiction. Local publishers are more willing to produce local novels. There is a market for new local fiction, and crime fiction is only one of several genres benefiting from this. But the growth in local crime fiction is also related to a boom worldwide. There is an enormous market out there for crime fiction, and an international appetite for new locales, for different settings for crime and its detection. Writers like Dion Meyer, Mike Nicol, Margie Orford all sell well overseas, all translated into several languages. And the global market for crime writing is, I think I've made this point before, is stimulated by films and television series in the same genre. But there are also other less immediate, less visible reasons for the proliferation of crime writing in South Africa. And I'm going to return to these later and ask why local writers have been drawn to the genre and why local readers, this audience included, consume crime fiction with such relish. But I'm going to begin by examining the crime fiction of Dion Meyer. Meyer is the most successful crime writer in terms of sales both locally and abroad, but I think he's also the most interesting. He writes in Afrikaans, but the English translations have a devoted following here and abroad. His crime thrillers are taut, pacey, adrenaline-charged narratives with many of the stock features of the genre, the manhunt, the chase, the shootout, the denouement, and so on. But they are also psychologically subtle, socially acute, and technically sophisticated. In almost all of Meyer's novels, he weaves separate narrative strands. It's not just a single story. He typically runs plot lines in parallel, weaving in and out of one another, making quite strenuous demands on his readers. And so it's all the more rewarding when the strands finally converge and the reader, like the detective, can make sense of the whole. I'm going to discuss four of the eight novels thus far translated into English. They're the ones on your left. Dead Before Dying and Down. I'm also going to quote from the one at the top of the other list, Dead at Daybreak, hence its asterisk. But the four on the left are police novels. The other four on the right-hand side are variants, really, of the hard-boiled Private Eye type. They're Private Eye thrillers. Each one of them pits a lone individual against apparently impossible odds and some memorable baddies. So you have Zapik van Heerden, Tiny Mpayapela, and two featuring Lemmer, bodyguard and security worker. But the four I'm considering are listed in their order of publication, and that is significant because the cast of characters develop and grow and change more or less in real time. These four are South African police procedurals or police novels. Over their course, we get to know a cast of characters who are members of the South African Police Service in Greater Cape Town. We learn a good deal about their operations, the actual techniques and things that they use, and the difficulties that they encounter. And at the heart of these novels is Captain Benny Griesel. Honoring him with Captain, he only gets promoted in the third of these novels, but I shall call him Captain Griesel. Griesel, in fact, was only a minor character in Dead Before Dying, but he is absolutely central to the others. And we get to know him very well. His Afrikaner working class background, he calls himself the Boikie from Paro, his battle against alcoholism, his relations with his children, beautifully done, his commitment to his job, and the reasons that he's so good at it. And Mayer, in fact, I heard on a BBC interview, says he's based Griesel on an actual Belleville detective. Now, I'm going to say something very briefly about the plot of each of these four books. That's a reminder to those of you who have read them and a kind of trailer to those of you who have not. But I'm not primarily concerned with the storylines. Instead, when I finish sketching the storylines, I'm going to propose some overarching themes, some ways of thinking about how the novels work. And these themes also allow me to draw in some other South African crime writers, particularly Margie Orford. Dead Before Dying begins with Captain Matt Joubert contemplating the possibility of suicide. He is in crisis, personally and professionally. He is mired in depression since the death of his wife and her betrayal, and is also now being put under pressure by the new commanding officer of Belleville's murdery and robbery squad, Colonel Bart De Wit. De Wit was a former member of the ANC who studied policing while in exile. He confronts Joubert with his recent poor disciplinary record, and he gives him an ultimatum. Joubert must lose weight, regain fitness, and undergo psychological counseling. Simultaneously, Joubert has to grapple with a baffling series of murders. The weapon in each case, a late 19th century German pistol, the Brumhandel Mauser. And the victims are a disparate lot. A self-made IT millionaire, a gay jewelry designer, a Hout Bay fisherman, a hugely successful hairdresser, and an unemployed ex-carpenter. And there are no apparent links between them. The mystery is finally solved by establishing the events some years previously that had indeed once brought them together and then precipitated a series of revenge killings. By the end of the book, Joubert has lost weight, he's swimming a lot, he's given up smoking, and he's completed a course of therapy. He's also dating the widow of one of the serial killer's victims, and in later books he marries her. Devil's Peak also wraps a crime thriller around a detective's personal struggles. After 17 years of marriage, Benny Kressel's wife has had enough and she throws him out of the home. His alcoholism is also affecting his performance as a policeman. And Mayer gives a vivid sense of the grip that alcohol has on Kressel and how difficult it is for him to loosen that grip, but how doggedly he attempts to do so. But his fight against the bottle is only one element of a complex story. Kressel is initially investigating the murder of three middle-aged white women. And that crime is solved, quite unusually, about halfway through the book. But the two main narrative strands of the book concern, firstly, an ex-Nkontowesizwe soldier, Tobela Mpayepela, who turns vigilante after his young son is killed by criminals and sets about tracking down perpetrators of abuse against children. And then a separate strand is the story of Christine van Rooyen, a young Afrikaner single parent who establishes herself as an expensive call girl living and working in Tamboerskloof. One of her clients turns out to be Carlos, the local representative of a Colombian drugs cartel using Cape Town as a transit point in the drug trade between Latin America and Asia. These two strands come dramatically together when the vigilante kills Carlos, and this precipitates a conclusion of spectacular violence, lots of dead bodies, and a reasonably happy ending, a bit like an Italian opera. By the time 13 Hours begins, Benny Kressel has been dry for 156 days and has been recommended for promotion. But at 5:30 a.m. on the day in which this novel takes place, he's woken with the news there's been a killing in Long Street. And it soon emerges that the victim is a young American tourist. By then, the reader knows that the victim's friend, Rachel Anderson, is in flight, terrified, hiding in Upper Aranjezicht and being hunted by the same group of young men who a few hours earlier had cut the throat of her friend. Eventually, we learn that Rachel has a video implicating the men searching for her. But the full story of why the stakes were so high only emerges right at the end after Kressel rescues Rachel, who's by now minus three toes that had been slipped off by her captors to force her to speak. This description of her audio is pretty gruesome, but the reflective reader may consider that she escaped relatively lightly, because her captors were involved in smuggling poor Zimbabweans, Somalis, and Malawians into South Africa, for which the immigrants paid by providing organs for transplant, corneas, livers, and so on. From 13 hours to 7 days. By now, Benny has been on the wagon for 233 days, but he is also confronting the alcoholism of Alexa Barnard, a former pop singer struggling to make a comeback with whom he has fallen in love. Benny has been seconded to the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigations, the DPCI, known to all of us as the Hawks. Someone is emailing the police, alleging that they are involved in the cover-up of the murder of an ambitious young lawyer called Hanneke Sloot, and threatening in these emails to start shooting policemen until they arrest her killer. The police had in fact simply reached a dead end in that investigation, so Benny has to reopen the Sloot case, starting from scratch. But he and his team are increasingly under pressure as the sniper does indeed start shooting policemen. The two inquiries are run in tandem. Benny heads the Sloot case and his colleague, Captain Mbali Kabeni, tracking down the sniper. We first met Mbali Kabeni in 13 Hours, when on first encounter she appears an unlikely heroine. She's short, she's fat, she's addicted to fried chicken and chips. She is a rather comic figure, but we quickly learn, I'm quoting, that she is an outspoken, principle-driven, stubborn female detective. That she is formidably intelligent and relentlessly methodical. She's a minor character in the earlier book, but has a larger role in 7 Days. And in an interview recently, Dion Meyer has said that not all his minor characters interest him enough to use them again. Quote, but Kalyani just jumped off the page straight away. I have a real soft spot for her. Unquote. This novel revels in the organizational details of the Hawks. We meet the CATS, the Crimes Against the State team, and the TOMS, the Tactical Operation Management Services, and especially the IMC, the Information Management Center, which uses sophisticated electronic technology, accessing and then cross-referencing national databases. In the same interview I mentioned a moment ago, Dion Meyer spoke about spending several days with the elite unit in Cape Town. Quote, I came away hugely impressed and rather inspired. And he uses the structure and the modus operandi, this really quite high-tech policing of the Hawks, as a counterpoint to Benny's own somewhat lone ranger approach. And in the end, it is the teamwork of the group and their use of technology which reveals the connection between the original murder and the sniper. Let me step back from the details of those stories and make some broader comments about them. In an earlier lecture, I quoted Peter Messant on the police novel. And he says that at its best, it's an inquiry into the state of the nation, its power structures, and its social concerns. So that a police novel looks at the police, looks at the state, and then looks at social issues. And I've tried to adapt that three-layered approach to thinking about the novels of Dion Meyer and other current South African crime writers. Specifically, in the South African context, I want to ask firstly what these stories tell us about the role of policemen and women in a period of dramatic political change. Secondly, how do these stories relate more broadly to political transformation and the new South Africa? And thirdly, how do these stories diagnose the social health of South Africa, and are there any prescriptions on offer for those ills? Take the first of those, policing the transition. Dion Meyer writes perceptively and sympathetically about policemen and women, especially about the detective division in post-apartheid South Africa. But he's at pains to ensure that his sympathies are not uncritical. He's fully aware of the tainted history of the police force in this country, its grim complicity in the enforcement of apartheid, its institutionalized racism and violence. He's equally alive to the reality of corruption in contemporary policing. In Devil's Peak, it is Senior Superintendent Bierkes who's hand in glove with the drug cartel and who in turn recruits more junior officers. In 13 Hours, it is a commander of the Cape Town Metro Police. Benny Kriesel calls him the Field Marshal because of his fancy uniform. It is a commander of the Metro Police who provided cover and support to the people smugglers and hunters of Rachel Anderson. And in 7 Days, to my dismay, even John Africa, a likable senior officer who we've encountered in all the earlier novels, accepts a bribe. But Mac Joubert, Benny Chrysal, Mbali Kalani, and many of their colleagues are not corrupt. They are fallible human beings with their own shortcomings, but they are dedicated and hard-working police officers. In Dead at Daybreak, the main character is an ex-policeman, Zatopirk van Heerden, ex-policeman and an ex-lecturer on police studies, as it happens, and Meyer gives him these words. "We work long, impossible hours against a constant stream of criticism from the media, the public, and the politicians at a time of great political change. We were undermanned, underpaid, and overworked," unquote. And time and again, Meyer comes back to the triple pressures from press, public, and politicians on the police. He frequently restates the case of that quote I've just read out, although not usually as explicitly as this, rather by giving examples of the workload, the external pressures, and the difficulties of policing a highly unequal society. Meyer's view seems to me very, very similar to that of Anthony Altbecker, who spent a year observing police officers at work and then titled his book about them, The Dirty Work of Democracy. And for Meyer, it is dirty work that comes at a high price. The alcoholic Benny Chrysal is part of a long tradition within crime fiction. This is the trope of the damaged policeman, drinking and smoking too much, lonely, often divorced, estranged from family, bearing the psychic scars inflicted by his work. Nesbo's Harry Hurler, Mankell's Wallander, Rankin's Rebus, and many others fit the mold. Even Dexter's Morse is a slightly more genteel version of this type. Time and again, Meyer's police officers describe the stress of their work and the havoc it wreaks in their private lives. Here's van Heerden again, recalling his early days at murder and robbery. "It gave me nightmares and kept me awake, or woke me in the small hours of the morning. It made me drink and swear and blunted me on my stumbling path to find ways to cope with it all. It was a permanent state of post-traumatic stress syndrome, a never-ending attack. The murder scenes were only part of it. We worked with the scum of the earth, day in and day out, the trash and the debris, the crazy and the greedy, the hot-headed and the callous, the morally weak, a never-ending exposure to evil," unquote. Now, I'm just going to mention, he says it made me drink and swear. And I'm afraid that in a lot of the later quotations I'm going to read from Dion Meyer, there's a good deal of flukkere. He obviously believes that's how police, and it's probably correct, that that is how policemen speak to one another, and I didn't want to censor those quotes. So if you were watching British television, the advisory warning at this stage would be strong language, violence, and scenes of a sexual nature. But just to go back to this idea of the damaged policeman, damaged partly because of the nature of his or her job. And the critic Sam Naidoo has written, "Authors such as Mike Nichol, Margie Orford, and Roger Smith describe gang warfare, prostitution rings, corruption at every level, human trafficking, and in general, a society so psychologically scarred it is no wonder that detectives and investigators like Mace Bishop or Benny Chrysal are cynical, jaded, damaged, or disturbed." Let me move on to the second layer of this analysis, New Nation, New Africana. Meyer's crime novels have all been published since 1994. Dead Before Dying actually came out in Afrikaans as Phoenix in 1996, first of the series. He is acutely aware of how the new political dispensation has impacted upon policing. 1994 placed a double obligation on the South African Police Service, placed two sets of expectations on it. Firstly, the police were expected to fight crime and its perpetrators and to bring down spiraling levels of crime and violence. Secondly, and simultaneously, the police force must be reformed, must be purged of its past. It must become a politically acceptable agency, respectful of human rights, in step with the new South Africa. And this was a towering challenge. For decades, the South African police force had been the armed guard of the apartheid state, bullying and intimidating citizens. But in 1994, what was required was, and there was a name change, was a South African police service for a democratic South Africa. The task was nothing less than one of turning an army of occupation into a modern public service. And Meyer is very aware of that. His police officers find the new rules, the new regime, threatening. Benny Crissel reflected bitterly that the police force had now become the police service. Quote, the politically correct, criminal procedures regulated, emasculated and disempowered service. And don't even talk about the fucking constitutional protection of criminals' rights. Unquote. There is a splendid scene in Dead Before Dying when the new commanding officer, Colonel De Witt, addresses the 40 members of the Bellville murder and robbery squad. He wants three things from them, he tells them. Firstly, he wants loyalty. Loyalty to me, to your colleagues, and to the service. Secondly, I want dedication. Not 90%, but 100%. And, now I'm quoting, the detectives started to relax. The new man spoke a new language, but the message remained the same. He expected no more than any of his predecessors. More work at the same inadequate pay. Results, as long as his back was covered with the higher-ups. They were used to it. They could live with it, even if he had been a member of the ANC. Unquote. But De Witt goes on. The third thing he requires from his officers is, quote, physical and mental health. Unquote. Each officer must undergo a physical examination, and where required, targets would be set. I don't want to be personal, he went on, but some of you are overweight. There are those who smoke and drink, but we'll tackle it together. Together we'll change your lifestyle, help you get rid of your bad habits. Unquote. It's a gently humorous passage, but of course, De Witt's third requirement, that they lose weight and drink less, is a metaphor for the real challenge facing them. The police officers would indeed have to change their lifestyles and get rid of their bad habits. They would have to shed their history if they were to become members of a fully reformed South African police service. The most immediate form of transformation was altering the racial profile of the police service, but especially its upper ranks. In the first of the books in which Crissel appears, Dead Before Dying, we meet the hot-headed Lieutenant Leon Peterson, quote, murder and robbery's only officer of color, unquote. However, just a few years later, in 13 hours, Crissel is asked by the commissioner to mentor six new officers, picked from a much larger group of the newly appointed officers, in order to pass on some of the know-how that he's accumulated through 25 years in service. They'd been hand-picked by the commissioner, quote, as six of the best new people, four lean black men, one fat black woman, and one broad-shouldered colour detective, all in their early 30s, unquote. And Meyer uses the fact of Crissel's mentoring role as a very effective way of highlighting the changes taking place, and he does so in a positive way. I'll come back to that. Because at the same time, he is well aware of the difficulties that came with making the service more representative and with the application of affirmative action at upper levels. Early on, Creasel rages. The harder we work, the more we get shat upon. Look here, this is a white skin. What does it mean? 26 years in the force, and it means fuck all. Gave my whole fucking life, took all that shit, and along came affirmative action. Unquote. And one of the men he mentors, Franz Mandecker, the broad-shouldered colour detective, is no happier. Why, he wants to know, why is Mbali Kaleni being sent to join the investigation? Quote, because they push the darkies. That's why they send in Kaleni. I'm just there to fill their fucking quota. 8% colours. That's how many of us they want. We weren't white enough then. We're not black enough now. Unquote. But although he acknowledges the difficulties and reflects this legacy of racialized behavior, Mayer strongly supports the transformation efforts. In 13 hours, we see Benny Creasel interacting positively with Vusi Mdabeni, Franz Mandecker, and Mbali Kaleni. And all three, at different moments, make vital contributions to the case. Similarly, in 7 days, the two crucial breakthroughs in the Swoop murder and the sniper case are made respectively by Creasel's colleagues Vaughan Cupido and Kaleni. Incidentally, in this novel, 7 days, Kaleni, Mbali Kaleni, is the subject of much rumour and speculation about the incident in Amsterdam. And there are constant references to it without any explanation. We're told that she was among a group of detectives taking a course in Amsterdam, but, quote, something had happened to her. According to the Bush Telegraph, it was a great embarrassment, unquote, but nobody knew what. And finally, in the closing pages, after the case has been cracked, Kaleni gets up and addresses her colleagues. Longish quote. I heard the gossip, she said. I know I'm not popular. I know I can be difficult to work with. But let me tell you what happened in Amsterdam, so at least that can be out in the open. Dead silence. Our hosts, the Amsterdam police, thought it would be a treat to take us on a bicycle tour of the city. And I was too proud to tell them that I cannot ride a bicycle. I didn't want them to think that South Africans are backward. So I tried. And I lost my balance, and I lost my way, and I rode into a canal. They had to rescue me. And my pride kept me from laughing at myself, and I wanted to keep it a secret. But I've now learned that secrets have consequences. And she sat down in the midst of them. Unquote. Again, I think Mayer's technique is very impressive here. Embedded in this comic tale of mishap and embarrassment is Kaleni's pride in her nation, in the new South Africa. I didn't want them to think that South Africans are backward. And then there's the hint of her full acceptance by the group. She sat down in the midst of them. I, for one, cannot wait to read the next novel about Creasel and Kaleni, recently issued in Afrikaans as Quivra. Mayer supports transformation in South Africa, but he has another key political concern that runs throughout his novels. And that is a concern to rehabilitate white Afrikaner men. Particularly white Afrikaner men who have integrity, who serve the nation, and who are not racist despite having been trained in the apartheid system. Dion Mayer's books, says another critic, are a contribution towards helping to rehabilitate the Afrikaner language and culture and retool them symbolically so that they can be fully part of the post-apartheid multicultural South Africa. And at times, Mayer's approach can be a bit didactic, with his rehabilitation project somewhat intrusive. For example, the heroine and hero of Dead at Daybreak swap stories at about 5 pages length of how they broke with the politics of their parents, their church, and their community. Hope Benneker eventually says that, quote, I found a book about Mandela. and I read it, and it was like being reborn. And she decided at that moment to, quote, search for truth and, quote, not judge people because of their color, beliefs, or actions. Zaterdag van Heerden responded with his tale, at the heart of which is an encounter with an African intellectual who's been arrested in Pretoria for breach of the pass laws, sitting reading Breitenbach's poetry in his prison cell. And van Heerden says, that was my moment of truth. It changed me. Elsewhere, Meyer makes the case for the reborn Afrikaner more subtly. His own commitment to Afrikaner culture, and especially its music, is a recurrent motif through nearly all of these novels. And at one point, in 13 Hours, a veteran of the popular music scene gives a potted history to Deckard, one of the detectives being mentored by Christel. This man says, in the 70s, Afrikaners just listened to fluff. Jim Reeves, Gay Corsten, Min Shaw, Groep Tweer, pop, like I love you lyrics. It was the golden era of apartheid, and people didn't want to think, they just wanted to hum along. And then came Voel Vrij, Koos Kombuis and Johannes Kert Korrel. Voel Vrij was protest music in Afrikaans, you know, against apartheid. The students bought into that like you wouldn't believe, in their thousands, while mom and dad in the suburbs were still listening to Bless Bridges' love ballads. Unquote. For Meyer, this musical shift is an analog to the larger political shift that Afrikaners had to make. In their daily lives, in the real world, as well as in their music, it was no longer possible for thoughtful Afrikaners to hum along. In 13 Hours, Piet van Lingen has already been established as a good guy. He's the older man who feeds and tries to hide the fugitive Rachel. When he tells her about the book he's writing about South Africa after the Boer War. Longish quote, I'm writing it for my people, the Afrikaners, so that they can see they've been through the same thing as the black people are going through now. They were also oppressed. They were also very poor, landless, beaten down. But through affirmative action, they got up again, also economic empowerment. There are very great parallels. But the book is also for our black people, he said. The Afrikaners rose again, an amazing achievement. Then their power corrupted them. The signs are there that the black government is going the same way. I am afraid they will make the same mistakes. It would be such a pity. We are a country of potential, of wonderful, good people who all want only one thing, a future for our children. Here, not in Canada. Unquote. The sentiments may be voiced by the schoolmasterly van der Lingen, but they are clearly shared by the author. And then the third of these. Amongst the charges frequently laid against popular genre fiction, including detective stories, is that they are both formulaic and escapist. A critique of two novels by Mike Nicol is extended to the field as a whole. South African crime writing, contemporary crime writing, cannot render the elusive nature of historical truth, nor can it deal with ethical and political dilemmas. We may be witnessing, says those critics, a pervasive abandonment of the complexities of transitional politics in favor of the consolations of the genre. Abandoning complexity for the consolations of the genre. And this accusation sparked a vigorous debate about whether current crime fiction in South Africa can explore and critique the current political moment, whether it has in effect replaced the resistance novel of the late 1980s and early 90s. Consider the topics tackled by Dion Meyer and Margie Orford. Rape, child abuse, prostitution, human trafficking, drugs, gangs, gang warfare, violence against women and children, corruption. Corrupt policemen, corrupt politicians, corrupt lawyers and businessmen. These are hardly the stuff of light relief or escapist fiction. I agree in part with Christopher Walmes, a British critic. He says Mayer and Orford do not abandon politics for the consolations of the genre. They attempt to keep faith with some of the core features of serious South African literature: its capacity to document social reality, to expose injustice, and to conscientize its readers into different modes of thought and action, unquote. So he's saying, far from ducking these things, they grapple with them. But I think his approval needs to be qualified. No one should expect crime fiction to deliver faithful social realism or to provide a full ethnography of poverty and inequality. Dion Meyer has pointed out, quote, crime fiction can never be a panoramic window on society. It can only be a small window with a restricted view. And more explicitly, Margie Orford has commented on the restrictions imposed by the genre itself, writing feminist, political, crime fiction, but she's still writing crime fiction. One of the problems I found with Gallows Hill is that you can't mess with the genre. You can push against it at certain points. But one of the things crime fiction could never do is write a novel about how poverty functions in Guguletu, unquote. Then there is another, moving away from those for a moment, there is another very distinctive feature of South African crime fiction. It is saturated with history. More than any comparable body of crime writing that I've ever encountered, South African crime fiction constantly excavates the past. Time and again, villainy in the present is revealed to have links with villainy in the past. The torture and murder of an antique dealer at his home in Durbanville is the direct result of killings and theft by a group of SADF soldiers in Angola in 1976. The deaths of vagrant boys in Walvis Bay took place because when the South African nuclear program was dismantled in 1990, cakes of enriched uranium were hidden in the Namib Desert. A man in his 40s is being hunted in Kruger National Park because 20 years earlier he saw the electronic device being set up to kill Samora Machel to cause the plane crash. A complex revenge is exacted by somebody tortured 20 years before because she had been wrongly suspected of betraying MK. And so on. Contemporary crimes date back to late apartheid and the struggle, which was a time of betrayal and treachery. It's a bit like Cold War espionage fiction. Feeds off the complicity and the betrayal. Characters in many of the books have their backstories located there. There are other ways of emphasizing history in South African crime writing. Mala Nunn's novels, featuring Detective Emmanuel Cooper, are set entirely in the 1950s. Two novels have recently made direct links between the Cape's slave background and crimes in contemporary Cape Town. Andrew Brown's Stone Cold Lullaby, a wonderful title, Stone Cold Lullaby and Orford's Gallows Hill. And Margie Orford has explained, and I'm quoting, I turn to South Africa's past in search of the origins of the violence that endures so persistently in the present. And she believes that the Cape's slave past inflected colonial and later apartheid thinking regarding race. And her epigraph to Gallows Hill is from William Faulkner. The past is not dead. It's not even past. We shouldn't be surprised that the best crime writing from this country is preoccupied with the roots of racial violence and crime. South Africa's present is deeply inscribed with its past. We are haunted by our history, and so is the crime fiction. Which brings me back to the question I posed at the beginning. Why is so much crime fiction being written and being read in South Africa today? And it quite clearly has something to do with the context. They are being written and read in a society with very high levels of crime and very high levels of anxiety about crime and security. And quite clearly they serve a socially diagnostic function, Kavis Chetty has written, reflecting on the chaos and the questless violence that actually exists, and then finding some release, some catharsis from that. And it's not only in South Africa that crime fiction mediates between the anxieties of the readers and their desires for a simpler, more peaceful life. Stephen Knight has proposed that crime fiction as a whole is a body of literature assembled to speculate about social disorder, threats to property and the body, and responses to these. And he says, for the readers, such stories address their anxieties and provide vicarious relief. Christopher Warnes, whom I quoted a couple of minutes ago, follows Stephen Knight in suggesting that an integral function of crime fiction is the negotiation of social anxiety. Novels by Mayer and Orford, he says, serve this function for a middle-class readership, facilitating the negotiation of threat and managing anxieties that are consequent on the dissolution of the apartheid era's false certainties. It is a more uncertain present. The villains in crime novels give form and shape to the fears and insecurities of their readers. But the detective offers a semblance of control, restoration, and maintenance. I think this is a convincing reading of the books he looks at. And I was very interested, after I read that, to come across an interview by Margie Orford on her intentions. In fact, it's an article by Margie Orford in that issue of Current Writing. She is aware, she quotes the negotiation of social anxiety thesis and then continues, "My own impulse to write crime as fiction was a way in which to understand and then allay that fear of random violence." To understand and to allay. She's also commented, "What's satisfying about reading and writing crime novels is that you reap revenge. You gain justice. Somebody, somewhere, is arresting a criminal, is enforcing justice." To conclude, the course, and you've been a very loyal audience, thank you, the course has covered a fair bit of ground. I've tried to say something about crime fictions written at different times at different places. And I have proposed that the detective story, the crime novel, is not only a very popular form, but also one that can tell us a good deal about the society in which it is set. And in fact, I think one of the reasons that it stayed so popular, one of the reasons for the continuing pull of the crime novel, is that although it is a genre with its own conventions and expectations, its own rules, it is also a remarkably fluid, flexible, elastic, and inventive genre. It is this capacity to be both generic and protean, predictable yet shape-shifting, that constantly renews and invigorates crime fiction. Tonight's lecture has proposed that crime fiction is alive and well in South Africa. When Ian Rankin, the Scottish crime writer, visited this country last year, he said he was leaving with a suitcase full of South African crimes. And he compared it to the writing that came out of Northern Ireland, the crime writing after the Troubles. He said, quote, "It shows that the worst chaos is over. Now your authors are holding up a mirror to explain who you are and how you got here. There's the sense of freedom. It's brilliant." Unquote. Some of you might disagree with him and retort that it's not a sense of freedom, but a sense of insecurity that animates local crime writing. I shall leave you to decide that for yourselves. But, above all, I hope that these lectures have suggested some ways of thinking about stories of crime and detection that will enhance your pleasure the next time you pick one up. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to take comments or questions. The American ones were. That Black Mask, the magazine that launched them, was written for a male, blue-collar audience. It then, you know, you feel broadly, but when they were written, it was very much a male
I am a Dorothy Sayers, Josephine Tay, Agatha Christie fan. I started reading because we were coming to Madrid. J.P. McClure, Mayer, and so on, just to catch up on all the modern stuff. Do you think that the modern South African writers adhere to the old rule that you must allow the reader to know everything before you get to the doom?
I'm asked by a fan of Agatha Dorothy Sayers, Josephine Tay, somebody who goes against his reading, even golden age of crime fiction. And he said he's now read some, being forced to read some of what he's done. And asking, do I think that the contemporary South African crime fiction, Pure and Mayer and others, obey the rules? That rule of, you know, making everything known to the reader. I don't think they do, but I don't think those rules hold it. I think those are the rules for that particular, for the Clue puzzle. For an art, I mean, when you think about it, those murders were pretty artificial. And to kind of govern their artificiality, he came up with a these, the crime I'm talking about tonight, the crime fiction, is far from artificial. It's rooted in the real world. And if it is that the detective doesn't see, quite often the reader doesn't see either.
I've just read the latest video on Mayer in Afrikaans, and I want to say, possibly, or even slightly around the world, you've given it a try. It's
wonderful. That's
true. Yes.
I've been very proud of it so far. I've only read it in translation.
Do you know the vernacular
of his text? No. He's written about that. He's actually written, he says, the one thing that suffers in translation. Thank you.
is in Botswana, and his detective is a very amusing person who's in the
I'm thinking of doing Cassie, I can't remember, but they are out there. I think they've done particularly with the male and author is more prominent than overseas. Roger Smith also did a published overseas. Any final
questions?
Thank you. Ray found in the history of the verse. Talks about how much he talks about the proliferation of crime fiction detective stories, because much he needs to get an average detective story published and needs to get an average novel, and therefore there's a lot of nonsense out there, not actually well written stuff. How do we sort the wheat from the chaff other than by trying to get a view of what's happening in South Africa?
The proposition is that it's easier to publish crime fiction than serious fiction. That's quoting Raymond Chandler in 1948 or so. And I think you're suggesting that this may be true today, is that how do you sort the truth from the chaff? I don't know if there is a simple answer to that. Some of these books that are like reread for this course are sort of better than others. That's just a statement of taste or the personal judgment. I think the market points in certain languages, Mayer, authors, prominence in this literature, I think does tell us something. But I'm sure there is some substance of something published as well. Thank you all very much.
She was at Varsity with us.
Oh,
in Maritzburg and Durban, yeah.